Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
I'm excited for today's conversation as I welcome two extremely accomplished individuals in the bird dog world. Then the husband and wife team, the dynamic duo of Susanna Smith and Ronnie Smith. Today's conversation should prove to be a massive knowledge drop for the amateur and the semi-pro bird dog trainer alike. And I know our Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever audience will enjoy listening to Susanna and Ronnie. That has a love story wrapped around a bird dog story. They're intertwined. So as I say that, they both are grinning at me from ear to ear. Thank you both for suffering through the technology of Oklahoma to Minnesota to record with me today. I really appreciate it.
We really appreciate you having us on your podcast here.
Well, thank you, Susanna. This, you were the impetus. I think I posted about the Ask the Vet series, which is sponsored by Purina, and you were extremely complimentary of that series with Seth Bynum and Ruth Ann, our favorite vet. And I think you two are mutual friends, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
Really complimentary, Ruth Ann Lobos on their Facebook page. So thank you. And it got me thinking, well, why haven't I had Ronnie and Susanna on our podcast? And here we are. Let's start with Susanna. Maybe tell us, our listeners, you know, if they've been living under a rock and don't know Susanna Smith and Ronnie Smith, maybe a little bit of your background story leading up to. I want to hold on the love story. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your background first, Susanna.
So I grew up in far west Texas, right at the entrance to the Big Bend National Park. Hmm. We were about 35 miles away from the nearest town, so very remote. We grew up on a cattle ranch, and my passion growing up was really ranching and cattle and horses. It was my driving force then. But I've always watched animals in general, wildlife. They've caught my attention from my earliest memories. So always studied different animals, and we had dogs at the ranch. So we had, my sisters had some lion dogs, and my mom always had bird dogs. So I was exposed to it. It just, at the time of my life, it wasn't the driving force for me. And that has obviously changed over time.
You said your sister had lion dogs? Like mountain lion dogs?
So wow. We had a very dear friend that worked for the Texas Parks and Wildlife, Billy Pat McKinney. And he studied lions down in West Texas. And he and my dad were big buddies, so they would go hunt lions together and put collars on them and do whatever they were doing with the state, and that kind of bled over into our family, and we got to experience some of that.
Wow, that's fascinating. And then I know part of your story, you have this connection with ranching and in agriculture, and you went away to college, right? Tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about those years.
Well, I went to college at Texas Tech University, started out as an ag major and changed to general business. And then once I graduated, I took a little break from school, but ended up going back to law school at St. Mary's. And I graduated from St. Mary's there with my JD.
Which St. Mary's? What state?
In San Antonio, St. Mary's University.
Okay. And then this is the you didn't have that on your bingo card component of the podcast. And that's Susanna. You worked for the House Committee on Agriculture in Washington, D.C. before you became a bird dog trainer. So to me, you're like a one in a million guest, somebody that has this connection to habitat and conservation as a member of working in the House Ag Committee, and then seeing our world, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever world, through the eyes of a bird dog trainer and hunter and bird dog lover. What did you do when you worked for the House Committee on Agriculture?
So I started out as an office assistant there, and then I became the assistant clerk. So I worked with the chief clerk at the time, was Callista Gingrich. She and I worked on the farm bill together. And to me, you know, ranching and ranch life, conservation issues, everything that Pheasants Forever works with and the Ag Committee, they're all so intertwined. It, it makes sense to me. So that was really the driving force behind me going up there. My family had been very active in private property rights and conservation all of my life. And so that was really the main reason I went up there, was to gain some experience doing that on my own and to see what, if I liked it or not. And I did love it up there. It was a great experience, but I also was able to make the decision that being back with my boots on the dirt, that was where I needed to be.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not unique from people that test out Washington, D.C. Some people stay and other people end up back home, and life is probably sweeter for having tested that and tried
Absolutely. It's a good experience.
Yeah, right on. Well, thank you for sharing. That's such a fascinating background. Speaking of fascinating backgrounds, Ronnie Smith, folks probably recognize the name. You've, I think, been at every single Pheasant Fest since we created the concept. And your family name is extremely well known, connected to bird dogs. You know, from Delmar Smith to Rick Smith to Ronnie Smith. Tell us how you fit into the family tree and a little bit about your background, Ronnie.
Right. So my father, Ronnie Smith Sr., and Delmar, my uncle Delmar, were brothers, and they grew up in Big Cabin, Oklahoma. And at that time, when they were young boys, there were a lot of professional trainers in and around Big Cabin. I assume it was because of the oil money. You know, there was a big play in Osage County, and a lot of people in Tulsa that had money, and so it was still pretty raw and wild, and a lot of game. So they grew up being around those pro trainers, and started to get some problem dogs. These two boys, these two kids. And looked at things a little different because they had no preconceived notions, right? So developed a quite a reputation. So I, like my cousins, Rick and Tom, Tom is Rick's older brother, we all trained dogs. And it has been a life study for sure. When I graduated high school, went to the hunting camps in South Texas. The King Ranch had opened up, started leasing all of that land in about 78, I believe it was, maybe 79. So that's the direction that I went, and trained dogs for the public during the summer and spent the next 42 seasons guiding hunts in South Texas.
42 seasons. Holy mackerel. And you're 46, just for our listeners.
That's right.
You started guiding at 4 years old.
Right?
was there ever any doubt you were going to be a dog trainer and a hunting guide when you were a kid growing up? Did you ever think about doing anything other than that?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was pretty certain that I didn't want to be a bird dog trainer. But as time progressed, you run out of, there were no options. So you just, you do what was in front of you. You know, and that's the way I went at it. And then as I got older, started to really appreciate, what it was that I did. You know, the majority of the guiding that we did was corporate. And so you listened to a lot of those guys, and I don't know, it kind of put it in perspective for me that even though it's stressful, even though it's tough, it's hot or it's cold or it's rainy or whatever it is, you have deadlines. If you can keep it in perspective, it's been a really wonderful ride. It really has. And as you go through your career, I think there are different things that become important to you. And right now, I think the thing that's the very most important to me and us, Suzanne and I, are really fascinated with the dog's mindset. You know, when I was young, they had to point back and retrieve, period. Mm-hmm. That was it. Point back and retrieve, and it didn't matter how you got there. And it's different now. We realize that if you focus on the dog's mindset, that all of those other disciplines come together.
Mm. I imagine you said 42 years, right?
Yes, sir.
I imagine, gosh, just some of the words and the perspectives, things have changed so dramatically. Like dogs lived outside when you started, and in the last decade, maybe, like almost all dogs you train, I'm guessing, live indoors with families. They're like, you know, anthropomorphized as children. I mean, is that maybe the major, or as I talk about that, what are the major differences that's changed in your mind? Like, as you think about that, what's the most significant difference in those couple of, you know, the last few decades?
Yeah, that you hit it exactly. That's, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, dogs were still a tool, you know, a means to go hunting and treated like that. They were not in the house. A lot of my father's clients at that time owned numerous dogs. They had a crew of dogs that they hunted with. And you know, it progressed or evolved to where, like you said, it's probably been 20 years ago that now all of the dogs, almost without exception, that we receive for training live in the house. And realistically, you know, 90-95% of their time are as pets. And it completely changed the way that we train dogs. We completely changed our format and our focuses on those dogs.
Completely changed. Like, top of the head, how did that completely change things?
Well, so a couple of things. You know, one, Susanna had beat into my head that, you know, I'm Ronnie Smith. I'm a bird dog trainer. And she said, Ronnie, you know, these dogs, they're pets. And first and foremost, and they hunt. And I'm like, I get it. That's great. But we're still training bird dogs. And we are still training bird dogs. But what we've realized is that the obedience is more important now than it has ever been. You know, if those dogs are obedient in the 95% of their life at home or in an urban environment, and that our owners are able to have a high level of obedience, able to enforce that, and then that will follow them positively to the field, because really they've just got to do three things. They've got to come with you, go with you, and stand still. And those things are what we can do in an urban environment or in the home or the backyard or the city park or wherever it is. The only thing that you lack is focus on game. So we encourage a lot of our owners, before you go on an extended trip, maybe go to your local preserve and get your dog refocused and intent on finding game, and then you're ready to roll.
I'm resisting running right towards the love story, because as I'm watching you guys, and I've watched a couple of videos of you. Purina has a fabulous video of the two of you. I think it's on your website too, if I recall correctly. Maybe it's on a Purina website, but it's funny. You have this, I wish I was filming right now, because you both have this unspoken eye contact. Like when you said, you know, Susanna had to beat it into me. And she, you know, Susanna's eyes kind of looked up and smiled. And it was similar in this Purina video that I watched. It's like Ronnie knew absolutely when to just stay quiet and let you answer the question. And it's just fascinating to watch the two of you. So I'm not going to run to the love story, but I am going to ask kind of a question that's occurred to me. It's like some of the best, absolute best bird dog trainers that I know are duos, they're teams. And a lot of times husband and wife teams, because they can call each other out. Like you just mentioned, you know, like Roddy, these are pets, right? Like, but we kind of, especially guys, right? Like we get stubborn, independent. I mean, I've done this for 42 years. I know what the hell I'm doing. And then Susanna has to be the one to be like, well, actually, you know, I mean, what's your reaction to that? Like, are you a better trainer, Ronnie Smith, today?
You think I'm going to answer that?
Because you married Susanna. I think, it's kind of apparent, isn't it? Like, you're a better trainer today than you were before. Is that accurate?
Oh, no doubt. That is no doubt. You know, it's the South Texas has made me who I am. You know, when you're out there in the good years or the bad years, and it's, you know, it's 95 degrees and you're trying to put on a hunt, or you know, it's dry, or whatever it is. It's absolutely made me who I am. So I know what a bird dog is. I know what a wild bird dog is. I know what it takes to be a wild bird dog. And you're right. You can get in a rut and keep doing the thing that works because it's always worked. But again, you know, times change, dogs change, and they have changed. And for Susanna to come in and have a different perspective, and I think what it all really pivoted on is that I completely respect her as a trainer. Mm. I have 110% faith in what she's doing. I think that we're different trainers in that timing is real important when you're training a dog for proper association or for any association. Mm. And our timing's a little different. You know, Susanna is more of a nurturer, so she's one that will give input to a dog and give that time to develop. And I am more one to make it happen. And I think because of that, we really complement each other. And we, I think we pull each other back to a baseline. And it's a very good environment. It's a good environment for us and a good environment for the dog. And it's the relationship. It's difficult. I mean, I have seen Susanna in the last 20 years, 24/7, more than anyone I've ever seen in my whole life. I mean, we're always together, and and that can be, you know, that can be difficult. Mm-hmm. But if you can keep it in perspective and realize that we're both just feeling stress, and try to make those corrections, just like you do with a dog. You know, yeah. We're doing the same thing with our relationship, mm-hmm. monitoring it and reading it.
Well, and I think those different perspectives too help keep us in check. You know, a trainer by themselves, if Ronnie goes off by himself or I go off by myself, and then we get back together, you know, say after a few weeks or something, the other one may look at the other spouse and say, Did you realize that you're doing this now with those dogs? Like, no, I had no clue that I had slipped into some kind of a rut that wasn't to the dog's benefit. So we're able to kind of help each other out and spot each other and keep each other going on the right track. And the difference in perspective, like Ronnie said, you know, men and women have different ways of seeing the exact same set of events. Mm-hmm. So we're able to kind of have a conference and say, okay, what do you think about this? And draw bits and pieces from each event. And we've changed our training format a lot just by doing that study in dogs and each giving our thought on the dog and coming to a better way to train just by using those different perspectives. So I think it's got a lot of benefits.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really cool to see you both interact with the unspoken word just as you're talking about dog training. It's really cool. It's fascinating. It's a compliment to both of you. You can see the respect and the love that comes out as you're talking about bird dog training, and that's amazing. You know, and you sort of, I think you started to answer this where my mind was going next, is you talk about different styles. Susanna's more of a nurturer. Ronnie, you're more like, let's get to the goal. I'm putting a little bit of words in your mouth, but I'm thinking about certain dogs are going to be better with Ronnie. Certain dogs are going to be better with Susanna, but there's probably a place for each style at each level of progression in each dog. So I guess that's the question. Do you both train the same dogs at different points, or do you look at their personalities and say, that one's going to Susanna, that one's going to Ronnie? Is it a both or an either or?
Yes and yes.
Okay. So it's a little bit of everything.
We try to make a point to swap which dogs were working, because like Ronnie mentioned earlier, everybody's timing's different. Mm-hmm. So if, say, I take a dog for a few weeks and that's my pet project and I'm bringing it through a rough spot or helping it with a certain area, whatever it is, and then I transition that dog over to letting Ronnie run it again, that dog goes through some stress with just that slight difference in the change in handling. And we see that in the performance. So, and we see it again when the owner picks them up. You know, there's differences in how the owner handles the dog and what that relationship is. So it's a hurdle for the dogs to move over. So by swapping back and forth, we try to get those dogs more adept at being able to have a consistent level of performance with different handlers. But that being said, if we've got a dog that is really struggling with something, it's very typical for one of us to take that dog over. Typically, it's because we have a stronger relationship with the dog, or we're getting a lot more accomplished. I know there was a little dog in this last class that Ronnie and I both loved working with her. But I couldn't push her through this hurdle that she was dealing with. Mm. And so Ronnie took her over, and his personality and his way of handling just, it meshed better for her. Mm. And then on the flip side, there was a little pointer female that we weren't making any headway with, and we just pretty frustrated with it. And I took her over and started doing some different things and got her in a couple of weeks. I mean, we were like, aha, we've got it going on. This is the direction we need to go. So it really depends on the personality and what the challenge or problem is.
Hmm. Well, and I'll tell you this too. Here's, you know, cutting hairs. The difference in timing between Susanna and I is about 2 seconds. You know, it's not huge, but that much matters on a dog like maybe a dog that's not got the best social skills, maybe a dog that struggles with mitigating stressors, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a reactive mindset. Mm-hmm. And that 2 second pause gives that dog 2 seconds to think instead of become reactive. And so for Susanna to work that dog, get it over the hurdle, and then I take it. So now it's got, this dog is used to two different types of timing. So mm-hmm. then the owner comes in, or the owners come in, and both of their timing is different. And it just helps that dog to adapt and overcome.
So I'm thinking about our listeners and some of the more seasoned dog trainers that they've done some things on their own and been shown, when they hear the word timings, two second to timing, some will understand and some will be like, what's he talking about here? And maybe put it into an example, Ronnie, because I think you're talking check cord, e-collar, like the split second when that dog doesn't execute what you've asked in the yeah. 2 seconds is a correction.
Right? Yeah, maybe it would be something like we're in the field and we're working on patterning, dogs going with us in the field and hunting their objectives, and you call on a dog to make a handling correction. I'm probably going to make a correction about 2 seconds quicker than Susanna. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like much, but it can be to the dog. Mm-hmm. So again, we have the ability to really tailor workouts for each specific dog. And then when they're leveled out and going the right direction, we will switch and throw a different cadence to that dog. Mm-hmm. Because again, when the owner shows up, the wheels will fall off the wagon mm-hmm. and you have to put it all back together.
Yeah, I can see that value in the mental acuity of the dog being able to adapt between one trainer, trainer A, trainer B, and then the owner is purely trainer C. Yeah. So if they only know trainer A, trainer C, the owner, is going to be a challenge. But if they go A to a B to a C, that progression actually it helps with their mental state of being able to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Right, and then there's a D, and there's, if they're children, there's E's and F's, and you know what
I mean. Great
and,
point.
And the dog can yeah. have an individual relationship with each one yeah. of those people.
Yeah. Breeds. When certain breeds come in, do you stereotype it? Well, Susanna's going to get that breed. Ronnie's going to get that breed, or is it purely individual dogs, and it's hard to categorize breeds versus in more stubborn versus more nurture needed.
Yeah,
personality, I think, drives everything that we do.
Individuals.
Yeah, it's the relationship. Yeah. You know, the relationship is the timing and the relationship. They're extremely important, and that's really what it's. I mean, again, we both work all the dogs, but if we're having trouble with one, then that's where we really are able to capitalize on each individual talent.
Yeah. All right. So we've made it to the love story. And I don't know the love story other than a piece of it. And the piece of it I know reminds me of Tina and Tom Dokken. So who's going to tell me this love story that involves a German short hair?
Susanna.
Okay, I'll start us off. So when I was still working at my family's ranch in West Texas, I bought my first bird dog that was all my own. Hmm. I went out and I got a little short hair. And, I'd been around bird dogs all my life. I thought, I can handle all the training. It's piece of cake. Well, this little dog was a lot stronger willed and had a bigger motor than anything I had ever dealt with. And that possibly stands true today as well. She was a lot of dog. So as I got ready to go back to school to go to law school, I I started looking for a trainer, and I'd relocated to down by San Antonio, and I realized that, you know, the legendary Rick Smith was 5 miles down the road. So it was pretty obvious who I needed to send my dog to get trained. And so I called Rick up and you know, tried to get my dog in. He's like, sorry, I can't help you. I'm not going to be able to receive any dogs in that time frame.
Well, and this is Rick, Ronnie's cousin.
Cousin, yes.
Okay.
So I asked him, you know, if he had any ideas of who I could go to. And he said, well, my cousin up in Oklahoma might be able to squeeze you in. So,
so was he matchmaking you? Was this deliberate?
No, it was a phone conversation. He didn't know me from Adam.
Oh, okay. So he's not Cupid in this scenario.
No, he might've played Cupid a little bit later on, but no, he got me set up with Ronnie, and I actually was going on a work exchange program in Australia. So I actually left the country before Ronnie was able to start working with my dog. So we had a gentleman that lived down there by San Antonio actually brought my dog to Oklahoma for me for training. So I didn't even meet Ronnie before he got the dog. And when I came back and picked up the dog, he was in South Texas guiding hunts at the Mariposa Ranch, and cell phone service down there, particularly at the time, was virtually non-existent. So here I am back in the States and wanting my dog, just like every other dog owner out there. I was concerned about her well-being, and I wanted her back. And it took me a little while to get a hold of Ronnie. And, you know, all these thoughts go through my mind. But when I met him, it was fate right then.
Really? Love at first sight?
Well,
silence.
He was an Oklahoman. I was a Texan. If you know Texans, that's a hard thing to get over. But yeah, he handed me my dog, and we did some transition work with her, and he was very honest with me. He told me, you know, I think she's going to need some more work. She's not quite there yet. So we worked that dog till the day she died, and I don't think she ever really was completely trained. Definitely never was completely honest.
Yeah.
So that's the dog that changed our lives.
And how long into that training or did you guys start dating and then get married? Like, how long into that dog's life?
We dated. Help me out with
that. We dated for 3 years. So.
We're, you know, married.
Okay.
The third year we dated. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had gotten a divorce in 2000, and I was never, ever getting married again. Never getting married again.
Uh-huh.
And this beautiful woman shows up to pick her dog up, and I think what I appreciated about Susanna the most is she showed up in a work truck with a flatbed on it with cattle feed on the back and baling wire twisted up and had cow manure on her blue jeans. And she was just being her, you know, she wasn't there to impress anybody. She was just being her and beautiful and intelligent. And I'll never forget when they pulled out, I was standing there by another one of the guides. And again, did I say I was never getting married again? And as she drove off into the sunset, I looked at him and I said, there goes my kind of woman. I knew, good Lord, that's exactly what I was looking for. But too bad, right? Because it's as far as it's going. And I don't know, we just, we talked a little bit and one thing led to another, and I don't know. It was just it was a wonderful thing. It really was. Yeah. It was a great thing for me.
Well, thank you for sharing that story with me and our listeners. It's like I should save this one for Valentine's Day 2025. We fall in love with our dogs, but you know, having the dog be the connector between two people that are clearly in love and very happy, you know, and you dropped a little bit of truth there a while ago, Ron. You know, it's probably really hard to work with your spouse, live with your spouse like every single day. And I know you guys have twins, right? A young boy and a young girl, and the whole family is wrapped up into every element of your life and business, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it is. It is 7 days a week, you know, and we're pretty remote where we live, and we're about a mile and three quarters off the highway at a dead end road. And, this is who we are. This is what we do. This is our life. And it is the majority of Susanna and I's conversation is dogs and business, and again, it's what we do.
But it's a unique way of life in that we are all four on the same path. We all understand that, you know, in our life, dogs are the driving force. Dogs are the they come first, and our kids have grown up. I mean, they have grown up in the training field. And as little ones, you know, they would mark time by how many more braces do we have to run before we go back to the kennel. so we homeschool because we live so far out in the country, and we travel because of the dogs and everything. So we've always homeschooled. And so our kids, they will be sitting out in the middle of the pasture while we're working dogs, and they'll be sitting in the cab of the hunt truck and be working on school, and we'll get back and be working on changing dogs and maybe getting some more pigeons, whatever. And a door will open and Gage might pop his head out and say, "Hey mom, can you come over here and help me with this math problem?" Like, okay. So we'll take a little time out and we'll, you know, work with the math problem. But the common thread through everything in our lives is the care and welfare of the dogs. You know, the kids don't expect to be able to go eat dinner because it's 6 o'clock or whatever time. We have to take care of the dogs first. And they always, they're a part of everything. So they help us feed the dogs. They help, one of their jobs this summer is washing buckets. You know, they have a vested interest in the same thing that we do. Yeah. So I think that helps, you know, when tempers flare and things aren't so easy, it helps keep us on the right path and keep us oriented the right way.
Yeah. Do your kids each have their own dog or like that they raise and train and care for, or is it kind of the family, you have family dogs?
So they each have the dogs that, are probably their number one dog. For Gage, it's Old George. Old George is a guide dog that we bought in Mississippi when he was a couple years old, and he'd been on our guide string forever, and he's just this really kind-hearted, quiet demeanor dog that he just has always spoken to Gage. So if I'm missing Gage at the kennel, probably he's crawled in the dog box with Old George and they're hanging out together.
And what breed is Old George?
He's a English pointer. He's an orange and white English pointer.
Nice.
And then we raised a litter a few years ago, and Reagan kept a puppy out of that litter that was an orange and white pointer female named Mint. And without a doubt, Mint is Reagan's dog. We laugh about it because Ronnie had nothing to do with Mint until this past hunting season. And all of a sudden he starts banding around that Mint is his dog. But, Reagan has been invested with that dog from day one. So and they all help with all the dogs. They all have a bond with all the dogs and take ownership. But those two are really the special ones for our kids.
All right. So folks, you know, if they Googled Rick Smith, Ronnie Smith, Delmar Smith, the Smith method of training comes up on the Google machine pretty quickly. Ronnie, if maybe put it in an elevator story. If somebody were to, you know, pop out of the truck and say, what's your training philosophy? Let's start there. Well, how would you put it into an elevator story for somebody that maybe doesn't know the Smith method?
Yeah, you know, I think, I think, again, I would go back and reflect on those two boys in Craig County, Oklahoma, you know, Big Heaven, Oklahoma, with problem dogs that, the conventional wisdom was not fixing. So they looked at things, they looked at the problem maybe more than the cure, right? And tried to diagnose what can they do to change this dog. And that's really been the premise of our format the whole time is, you know, association. I'll tell you, so we have the what we call the silent command system of training. And what that is we teach dogs all of the disciplines that they need to know before we ever put a name to it. So we'll have dogs healing. We'll have dogs where we can stop them, call them to us, handling all of those things, before we put a command to it. And, by doing that, I think a difficulty that a lot of people have are that a dog communicates with the inflection in your voice, the inflection of your body, of your movement, what scent, smell is coming out of you. That's how they communicate. That's how they observe the world. And people, I think that we communicate with words. With the English language. And I think a lot of folks struggle teaching their dogs things because they try to teach a command. Like, let's say, whoa. If you're not careful, if you can differentiate the training and the word, then it's not a problem. But if you try to teach a dog, whoa, you get focused on the command. You're trying to teach the English word. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Right. And to the dog, that's just the inflection changes, but it's just a sound. So I think our format really, puts a dog in a controlled environment. We have points of contact, the neck and the flank. We work toward a conditioned response and practice to the point of learned behavior. There's 90 days right there in a nutshell. But it's really about the psychology of the dog more than anything. We're constantly studying and evaluating a dog. You know, we have a very structured format of training, and everything that we do is for a reason. It's an absolute program start to finish. But In this program that we've got, you can look at it as maybe a centipede, right? So the body of the centipede is our format, but the legs, laterally on left and right side of the body, that's the corrections that you make. That's the changes that you make watching the dog, because you might do something on the right side. And two steps later, it's completely different now. So your input needs to be 180 degrees from what it was initially. So it's really about reading the dog to make the right and the correct choices for that dog, for the mind and the association.
And Suzanne, anything you would add to Ronnie's explanation of kind of your philosophical approach to training?
I think so Delmar and Ronnie Sr. started training in the 50s. And I think about then, you know, there was a lot of change in how trainers worked with animals in general. And one of the earlier inspirations for Ronnie and Delmer was the instructional booklets from Professor Barry, who was a horse trainer. Mm-hmm. And in the horse world at the time, that was just really, I guess, when the shift was beginning to where trainers were expecting to be able to get on a horse and start riding without having a horse bucking and fighting on you. Have a horse willingly accept leadership. And a lot of that evolved from points of contact. A lot of that evolved from, you know, teaching an animal what a cue was and doing a lot of very basic work before you asked anything huge of the animal. So by the time you got to those big asks, those big challenges, the animal was prepared and didn't have as much stress and have to sort through so much. So, you know, to me, the analogy is just like with the horses. You know, 100 years ago, cowboys would throw a saddle on a horse and it would buck every time they got on it for the next month. But eventually they'd have a broke horse, and that was breaking and not really training. I mean, you went about it. The animal was a tool, and eventually you were going to have an animal that you could work with and trust, but it was going to take a long time to get there. Whereas nowadays with the natural horsemanship movement over the last 40 years, you know, most horses, by the time you get on them, you can turn their head with a cue. You can turn their hind end or their shoulders with a cue, and you get on them and they never buck with you. So the same thing has happened with the bird dog world, in that, you know, when Delmer and Ronnie Sr. were starting out, things were pretty elementary. You know, a lot of bird dogs didn't make it. The training process was a lot more rigid. The dog either did what he was supposed to or he was going to be out. And Ronnie and Delmer started studying the animal, the why of the animal. What can we do to get that animal where we need to? And a lot of it, you know, it wasn't just dogs. They played with, they raised cattle, and they had horses. And I remember people in Big Cabin talking about how those boys were always messing with some animal, you know, whether it was a coyote or what, they were always messing with some animal. But that's it. They were learning how to work with an animal's mindset, no matter what species it was. It was all about the mind. And that's really, you know, the foundation for this training system, is how to work with an animal's mind to get them to a level that we expect. And, you know, as the decades click off, hopefully we're just getting better and better at reading an animal and helping that animal with whatever quirks or weaknesses or stress points they have. We're equipping our animals to deal with the world that we're presenting them with.
Here's an absolute out of left field wild card question for you. Susanna, is a horse or a bird dog smarter?
Ooh. I would never think about that, because to me they're so similar. It's the same mindset. So I really couldn't answer.
Really?
Depends on the individual.
I wasn't expecting a push. Okay. So mindsets, in studying up for this conversation, on your website, you have three core mindsets: compliance, composure, and confidence. Tell me about those three C's and what they mean in your philosophy, Susanna.
So we came up with the three C's, I don't know, a few years ago, trying to decide what traits make some dogs more successful than others. You know, we'll have dogs come in. COVID, the time period during COVID was the perfect example. We had dogs that just could not overcome the hurdles necessary to begin the learning process at our facility. They were too sheltered. They were poorly socialized. You know, maybe they had spent their entire life with their owner. So they had a lot of time with people, but it was typically just the owner or the family. And they were dependent on those people. They'd never been on their own, and they'd not been presented with a lot of new social situations. So when the dogs came into our kennel, a lot of them, we got a high percentage, probably, what do you think, Ronnie, quarter of the class that absolutely were not receptive to training because they couldn't deal with the environment and being away from their owners. But some of those dogs would go from the absolute bottom of the class where we weren't certain if we were going to be able to train them to being top tier performers, to being able to learn and process and have good cognitive skills and be really proficient on their game. So it got us to thinking, so what is the difference? It wasn't breed. It wasn't necessarily a consistent background. It was those traits. The calmer, more composed dogs, they can think. They can work through things that stress them instead of just reacting or overreacting. Dogs that visual dogs tend to be more reactive. And a visual dog is a very hard dog to train because it's hard to keep their attention. You might have their attention for a couple of seconds, and then a butterfly moves and they've completely forgotten what's going on. and they may overreact if you cue them or anything happens during that time when they're watching that butterfly. So those reactive dogs are very difficult to train, but a composed dog is more aware of everything going on around them and more apt to make a good decision. So that composure is, I think, key. Confidence. A confident dog is not going to misread your intentions. A confident dog is not going to be fearful when somebody walks up to them and snaps a lead to their collar. A confident dog is not going to be as aggressive. A lot of the aggression that we see is actually fear-based aggression. Mm-hmm. So confident dogs, you just don't see the aggression. They're not in a fight for their life kind of mindset. So that confidence is key as well. And then the compliance. Compliance is an animal's willingness to listen to cues and to be directed. And a lot of that they learn at a young age. You know, there's a lot of imprinting with how you handle an animal and teach them that you are actually talking to them through body language, through physical cues. You know, pressure on a lead, it has meaning if the owner's consistent. So a dog that learns that pressure on the lead means to move, then they're able to progress up to more challenging learning skills. So that compliance is really kind of the foundation for them to go to school.
Ronnie, anything you want to add to Susanna's comments there about compliance, composure, and confidence?
Yeah, no, I think she absolutely nailed it. And again, that's one of the things that you know, that changed with the dogs that we received for training is all of a sudden we saw a different dog. I mean, you would see a small percentage of those dogs, but all of a sudden it was across the board. You know, and you're like, wow, they are really crippled in trying to take a mindset through a program and teach them something when, like Susanna said, a lot of what you did with them could be misperceived just because of their fears. It was difficult. We learned a lot from that. It made us better trainers.
One of the examples that I think about when I think about that time was that we received a young Brittany female in for training. And for the first 10 days or 2 weeks, we could not go in her kennel without her running to the back of the kennel, growling or barking at us. So that mindset, you can't take that fearful mindset and teach it anything. You know, at that point, you're just trying to get a baseline. You're trying to build some confidence and some trust. And she was actually one of the dogs that went from that state of mind when she got here to being one of the top dogs in the kennel, one that you could go to her in the kennel, snap your fingers. That's one of our cues to heal. Just snap your fingers and she would heal you anywhere you went, had a super attitude, willing to do whatever you wanted to do, flew around in the field, was looked like a million bucks on birds, had confidence in the field. So those are the dogs you think, well, why her and not this next dog, you know, two runs down. And that's when we decided that it was those three factors. She inherently had those three factors that brought her to the top, and we were just able to shape it through our training.
It's really fascinating. If you dial back the world, you know, 4 years ago, who would have ever predicted that COVID would have such an influence on bird dog training? Let alone all kinds of other things, right? But who thought, you know, here we'd be sitting in, you know, the summer of 2024, and you're like, you've reframed a bit of your training process all around a worldwide pandemic because dogs were spending too much darn time with their owners and not getting socialized. You know, it's like, yo.
But maybe the one good thing that came from COVID was it made us better trainers.
Yeah, that's. I think it was you, Susanna, a few minutes ago, and correct me if I'm wrong, you used the word honest to describe a dog. Explain that to me. What does a dog, how is a dog honest?
So I think I used that when we were talking about my first short hair, Abby.
I think you did, yes.
And the reason I used that with her is she was an anomaly. I mean, she was tough. She was hard to handle. She was unlike any other dog I've ever worked, put it that way. And she's probably the only dog that I loved her dearly, but she is the only dog that I can think of that I could say she probably wasn't honest. She was the kind of dog that was so strong-willed. I remember Ronnie running her in South Texas, and she got on some hogs. And so he corrected her off the hogs, and she came back, ran straight to the truck, looked at him, and barked at him like she was letting him know that was not acceptable. Just a super strong-willed dog. I think in Ronnie, correct me if you feel differently, but I think for both Ronnie and I, we really feel like honesty is a consistent trait across all dogs. Dogs live in the moment. We feel like dogs are pure and genuine in everything they do. So we don't see their mindset as being one of dishonest, maybe stronger willed. So usually we don't even use the word honesty with the dog.
Yeah. I think some dogs, like people, struggle with impulse control. Right. But yeah. Once a dog, if you're ever able to have a dog join up with you, right. Again, it's a relationship that's not based on words. It is a dog that will willingly look to you. You know, he's a pack animal, and he assumes his role, his position in that pack, and looks to you as the leader of that pack. And it's an honest walk through the fire with you kind of relationship. That's why we let that animal live in our home. This domesticated predator live in our homes because they have the ability to do that, you know, to join up with you and it's a deep relationship.
It's one of those words that, you know, folks use with bird dogs, but it's what, you know, it kind of struck me as like, what does that really mean? You know, you put your explanations together and it's sort of, dogs don't have ulterior motives. Right? Like, you know, dogs, we do this, we anthropomorphize animals and we put human thinking into dogs. Just Ronnie, like you were explaining with the use of the English language, like it's similar and with the dog being quote unquote honest, it's like the dog is looking for you for a cue. Because what's the relationship in the pack? They don't have an ulterior motive. Because you hear people say, oh, yeah, that dog gave me the bird and did whatever they wanted to do. It's like, no, they didn't have the right relationship or you didn't give the proper signal. And they didn't you know, they didn't have an ulterior motive. They didn't understand, and they went and did what they thought was the right thing.
I think you're dead on there in that it's the dog's lack of impulse control. They did what they wanted to do, and mm-hmm. it just didn't align with what we wanted, and maybe we hadn't prepared that dog to be real consistent. And I think that's what we see the most often when somebody says the dog isn't honest. It's the dog just doesn't understand or just simply cannot control their impulses.
Yeah.
They live in the moment.
If you were, so here we are, middle of summer, there's probably a whole bunch of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever members that have pups at home 5-6 months, and it's time to start thinking about bird and gun introduction and, you know, doing some training. If you were to give advice to our audience on question, like what are the questions you should ask of a trainer, you know, if they live anywhere in the country, like what's the guidance? Like, make sure you ask this of a trainer, look for this. Any wisdom you would pass on to our audience, like knowing that everybody can't come to, you know, Oklahoma, right? They live in Virginia and California. Like, there's all sorts of trainers there. What would you offer as advice to our audience?
You know, I think for me, my first piece of advice for people would be don't assume that your dog is going to go away to training and come back like a programmed computer.
Mm.
Your dog will have a set of experiences that hopefully shape their behavior. But if the person handling that dog doesn't know or understand the training that was put in to achieve that behavior and can't enforce it, then all that training is going to be for naught. Because if you can't maintain it, it's going to erode. The analogy I use is that, you know, when I was in college, I took German and Spanish. I cannot speak a lick of German or Spanish now because I haven't used it. And dogs are the same. If you don't utilize the training that they receive, then it just erodes until it's virtually not there anymore. So you need to be able to understand the training format that your dog is going through, the curriculum, if you will. Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to implement it in your life with your dog. So a lot of that is going to depend on the trainer's ability to convey what they're doing and why. So that's critical. I know we've had people in the past that will come to us and say, okay, I've got this dog and they're flushing birds and I don't know what to do. And first question is, well, have you tried to stop them? Well, I don't know how. So if you have a trained dog and he's flushing birds and you don't know how to stop him, there's a real disconnect there. So if we can understand the training and how to implement it, then we'll be able to keep that performance at that level. And I think that's key for people across the country.
Yeah. And, you know, we tell our clients when they bring a dog, and we say that regardless of how long you leave your dog here, when you show up, the relationship that you have with him now will be the same. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of people say, will he forget me? And we're like, no, that's the problem. You know, if mm-hmm. if a dog would forget you, you could fly him to us. We could program him and fly him back and it would work. But it's relationship based. Yeah. So it doesn't work that way. I think what Susanna said is so true. You need to know how to keep your dog together, because as soon as you go home, we're all creatures of habit, mm-hmm. and we fall back into our old roles, and it will erode. It will degrade. Mm-hmm. But if you know how to put it back together, the dog back together, hopefully through just the obedience is all that you need, then again, that will follow you positively to the field. You know, I tell people, if your children don't mind at home, then they're not going to mind at the state fair, you know, with all of those distractions. Yeah. So it really starts there.
I think about the variables involved. The first one is the dog. The second one is you, say the primary owner. And Ronnie, you brought this up earlier. Trainer DEF, the kids, the spouse, you know. So as I think about this, like, you know, when I've sent one of my pups away for some help, some training, it's like 60% of the work with the training is the relationship between the trainer and my dog. And then the other 40% is the trainer training me how to reprogram me to be a better, or to be consistent with what has been trained in the dog that I left there. So I feel like one of the best pieces of advice that was given to me and I would pass along is, like, you can't just drop off your dog, leave it with, you know, Susanna and Ronnie, then come up for 5 minutes and go home and it's done deal. It don't work like that. Like, you have to plan some time for Susanna to train you a little bit too, right? I mean, when you pick up your dog, you need some time to learn what your dog's learned so you can reinforce it and stay consistent. I mean, that's a really important component, isn't it?
And I think something that everything you said there is so true, but something that we often don't think about is what the dog is going through when it's making that transition from the trainer's facility and their handling back to the owner's. So the dog assumes the relationship with the owner is the same as it was the day the dog was dropped off. Yeah. And now it's got almost two competing behaviors in its repertoire, you know, and having to decide, okay, I jumped on my owner before training, but for the past 3 months, I haven't been allowed to jump on anybody. Can I jump on them? Okay, I can't jump on the father. Can I jump on the wife? Can I jump on the kids? You know, they have to sort through all that. And the stress those dogs go through in figuring that out is immense. Yeah. We've had people, you know, after they picked up their dog from training, say, you know, their dog slept for 2 days, and it was because of that stress trying to sort out what rules from school still apply and what rules from home are still in effect. And we've had dogs that surprised us with the behavior they showed. So we think we know an animal because we have worked them consistently for 90 days. We think we know all their quirks and individual, you know, personality. And we know the trouble areas that we've had in the training format, right? We know, okay, when we started turning dogs loose, you know, maybe he didn't go anywhere or he ran off the edge of the earth. You know, that's an area we're going to have to help the owner with. We expect that. But things will pop up that we've never seen as trainers. In 3 months, we've never seen a dog exhibit this behavior. But just because the owner's back in the picture, the dog will do it. And we're like, whoa, where did this come from? So it's fascinating. It's a challenge, but it's fascinating when you look at it from the dog's perspective. They're trying to figure out the relationship and what they're allowed to do. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah. You know, I used to take it personal whenever an owner would show up and we'd see some of that behavior, you know, that old behavior exhibited. And I would think, how can the owner imprint this dog deeper than me, right? Mm-hmm. And then when I realized it's just a relationship, it's just a different relationship, then it helped me sort through that. But when I was in my 20s, I struggled with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see it. It is. It's part of the evolution, right? Like, it is so much about, as you've talked, it is a mindset and it is relationships to different people, to different, I'm sure it exists with dog to dog, you know, and it's all part of training the mental aspect of these animals. And that's what's so fascinating. And we get better and better, at least slowly over time, I'm getting better. thank you both so much. I'm looking at the clock and we're 1:10 and I've got like 2.5 hours worth of questions for you. But I'll move to a little bit more of a lightning round to be respectful. Again, thank you so much for sharing a lot of your personal story as well as your expertise here. All right, so lightning round of questions. I gotta ask, you know, so reading Ronnie's bio, you know, you've guided some amazing individuals, U.S. presidents, astronauts, sports heroes. Anybody stand out to you as, like, Boy, that was awfully cool.
You know, there are probably three people. I was fortunate to hunt both bushes, 41 and 43. Gene Cernan, at that time, the last man to walk on the moon. And Lynn Swann. You know, Lynn Swann played for the Steelers, and I grew up watching him as a receiver, and just he was amazing. You know, he was just, and when I got to see him and hunt with him, I don't know, it kind of threw me back to being a child, you know, and watching Lynn. You know, when he first, we were hunting quail in South Texas, and he wasn't shooting very well. But the world class athlete that he was, by the next day, it showed. I mean, he was center punching. I mean, just really, really an amazing athlete and neat experience. And Gene Cernan, you know, to listen to him talk about his experience landing on the moon and all that was involved in the colors and the light, and not many people get to experience that. A funny story with Bush 41 happened to be one of those days, right? You know, we always hear about all the birds that we find, and nobody talks about the days and days of zero to two coveys. And I have had many, many of those. I mean, a lot of seasons of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this one day, I did 57 coveys in 7 hours.
Oh. Right?
The only time in my life I've done that. Never even got close. Not even on that ranch in that same year. It was just one of those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget, he was standing there and he says, "This is unbelievable. I've never seen anything like this. This is unbelievable." And I'm standing there beside him, very composed, right? But inside, I'm screaming, "This is unbelievable. I've never seen anything like this." So it was, you know, to have had that experience with a president, one of our presidents, it was special. And I'll never forget, you know, those times like that.
No, that is that's great. That's a great story. Susanna, you know, you've been in this business a while now, and my perception as a man that the world's come a long ways to embracing women as dog trainers. What's your perception? Have we come a long ways, and do we have a long ways yet to go?
Yes and yes, I would say. You know, I've it's been a challenge for me. The perception that, you know, it's a guy's hunting world. You know, I've been in hunting camps where women weren't welcome. I've been told that I shouldn't ride on a hunting rig because I was a woman. I've had people that didn't want me to guide because I was a woman.
Is that right?
Yeah, so I've seen a lot of that, but I think as more women enter the hunting world and the bird dog world, it's just getting better and better. And as more women are able to not just shoot well, but also train a dog well, it changes the dynamics, you know. It makes it more both a sport that's friendly to women and friendly to the men. So yeah, it's challenging, but I think it's absolutely worth it. And I think it's getting better and better.
What piece of gear clothing has come the longest way for women? Like what, when you first started, you're like, "Oh, I couldn't find that." Now it's like, "I have this and I love it."
You know, I think it's still a challenge with equipment. To me, probably the most important is boots, good boots, because we, you know, we're constantly on the ground walking. We were walking 10,000 to 18,000 steps a day, and good solid boots that last. That I think that's gotten better, and there's more options out there for women.
And obviously, we work with a lot of companies. So talk about a product you want to be improved that hasn't come a long ways yet. That you're like, I just wish people would make this.
Oh, gee, help me out here, Ronnie. What am I always struggling looking for? Women's hunting pants are one.
Yeah.
That's the most common answer. Yeah. Yeah, that's the one that I was expecting.
Yeah.
It's hard to find really good upland hunting pants for women.
Yeah.
And I think guns, you know, guns, they've come. It's
come a long
it's
way.
Coming that it's going the right direction. But, you know, to find a gun that, you know, is that fits maybe is lighter, is more ergonomic, there's a void there.
That fits a woman's body, just like with the pants. Yeah. The general solution has always been, we'll get a smaller, lighter gun or a smaller size of men's hunting pants. Well, that doesn't work.
All right. We'll start with Susanna, go to Ronnie. You don't have to explain it. Just give one word answers. Favorite upland bird?
Oh, these are the hardest questions. Can I do two?
Sure.
Bobwhite quail and sharptail. They both have a sweet spot in my heart.
Great. Ronnie?
Yeah, I agree. Both of those birds are my favorite. Yes.
Favorite wild game to eat?
The same.
I'm going to say quail and trout.
And trout? Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Your favorite state to upland bird hunt?
Oh, that's tough. I'm going to say Texas because of all the time that Ronnie and I've spent there guiding and just the roots that we have there and the abundance of game.
Mine is Montana.
Your top bucket list destination. What do you dream of doing before you pass on, Susanna?
Hunt over a bird dog in Africa.
What bird?
Franklin.
Doesn't matter.
Guinea fowl, whatever. Yeah.
Just to run a bird dog.
Sweet. Ronnie?
Yeah. I think I would like to I'd like to see Argentina. And we've had opportunity to do that, but just can't find the time.
Very fun. All right. Your website, smithkennels.com. Anything else you want, like you want people to follow on social media channels or go to any place you'd point folks to the website, or if you want to throw out your social media handles, go for it.
Sure. Yeah. Our website's one place to connect with us. We're on Instagram, Smith Kennels Bird Dogs, Facebook, Smith Kennels. Those are three good places to connect with us.
Great. And you're members of the Purina Pro Plan Pro Staff, which means you'll be in Kansas City with us come March.
That's
as
right.
You always are. Yeah. You were in Sioux Falls and Minneapolis and Omaha, and can't thank you enough for the relationship that you guys have with our organization to share your expertise and honestly your love story with us on this podcast. You guys are both giggling, but it was really sweet to see kind of the interpersonal relationship that you both have even before I got to the love story and you know, the fact that you spend every waking hour together training dogs, but there's clearly so much joy between the two of you. And even though Ronnie said he'd never get married again.
Yeah, did I mention that? Did I?
sincerest appreciation for sharing your story and over an hour with our audience has been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much for having us on here with you. It has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, folks. Thank you for listening. That website again, smithkennels.com. www.thebeatsmith.com. You can check them out. Right at the top right corner of the website is a link to Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and their contact info is on their website. For Susanna and Ronnie, I'm Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.